I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Ruler podcast. My name's Jack Thurston, and this is the podcast for issue 51 of Ruler magazine. And round the table here at the Ruler offices are editor of the magazine, Ian Cleverly, and assistant editor, Andy McGrath.
Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jack.
Hello, gents. Fantastic issue, this one. And you must note that I don't always say that in the podcast. Doesn't mean that I don't always like the other issues, but this one is one that I really feel like I can say this is one of the great issues.
Very good of you to say so. No, I don't ever remember you saying anything like it before, frankly. We'll take that.
There's a lot of variety in it and some amazing photographs, of course. And that's where we start in the podcast, isn't it? Picking out our favourite photographs from this issue. Do you want to go first, Ian?
There is a shot of Lance Armstrong on a scooter pacing TJ Van Garderen. And he has this look on his face that says it's the most serious task in the world. It's just a beautiful shot by Jakob. And that's my pick.
He looks so ridiculous. That's the thing. He's got a baseball cap on backwards and he's on this Vespa. You can tell he's retired, basically. It looks really silly. But that's not my favourite. My favourite is one of Antonio Bigarini's from the Berlin Six Day. It's of a man in a bear suit, actually. It's one of four photos on the page, and it really sums up the spectacle and the silliness of 6 days and kind of still ties it back to its past, which is what the article's about. So I absolutely love that.
Have you been to a lot of 6 day races yourself?
Confession time, I've never been to a 6 day race, not even one day of it.
Ian?
I went to the Skull Six back in the day at Empire Pool, which was... fabulous. But it is show business, you know.
Yeah.
Let's make no bones about it. It's not serious racing, but
really,
yeah, I think so.
Throughout,
it doesn't matter though.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
It's a spectacle. I mean, the photographs of the Berlin Six are breathtaking. Should there be a 6 day race in Britain?
Possibly. There's time for it. I think there may have even been discussions about one in the near future in the UK. Certainly, if not now, then when? Because surely it's the best time. Then the other kind of issue is, can you hold people's attentions for 6 days, and can you get the stars to turn up and race hard for 6 days?
You will if you pay them enough.
If you pay them enough, yeah.
Because Ruler's been involved in the Revolution series, which has been a kind of innovation in track racing, but you'd put that in a very different category from 6 day racing, would you?
Yeah, I think so. I suppose it's a similar thing. It's just that it's spread out over the whole winter, so there's not...
And is that real racing?
No comment.
Okay, well...
Yes, of course it is.
moving swiftly on to my photo choice, which is... I don't know if this is going to be yours, Ian, but it is the photograph, double-page spread, of Lars van der Haar leaping on his bicycle over a ravine on a cyclocross course, which I think, I mean, it's just a very arresting photograph. And the thing that I like about it is that it's like a Rorschach test for do you like cyclocross or not? Mm-hmm. Because the people who love cyclocross will go, God, yeah, look at this. It's amazing. Cyclocross, that's what it's all about. People who don't like cyclocross will go, look what a ridiculous thing he's doing, you know, what's he doing on a road bike in the mud leaping over a ravine, you know. So you could take it either way. Either it's a ridiculous muddy circus or it's poetry in motion.
Well, that's a perfect description of it, isn't it? But I think roadies that can't do that are just jealous, frankly. You know, they'd like to be able to do it.
Well, we'll come to our cyclocross debate later in the podcast. But let's start with Lance. Lance is the opening story in the magazine. Why?
Why not? I mean, but basically, Morten sent me an email and says, "Yeah, I'm going to go. I'm going to see if I can get Lance." And I just replied, "Yeah, whatever. Good luck with that." And then he came back about 2 days later and said, "Yeah, I've got him. We're going to Aspen." Morten and Jakob had this amazing ability to just get into people's lives and make themselves at home, which I don't know how they do it, but with anybody else, I swear Lance would open the front door and go, "Oh, it's a journalist. Great, come in, sit down, we'll talk for half an hour." With them, he opens the door and goes, "F me, it's the Blues Brothers." And, you know, because they're standing there dressed in suits, and, you know, he just welcomes them in and says, "Just make yourself at home." And then they end up spending like 2 or 3 days there.
I think they've got under Armstrong's guard, partly from the amount of time they spend with him. But I don't think it's such a PR offensive because it is much more relaxed and they are kind of having fun.
Isn't that part of the Lance game? Isn't Ruler being played by Lance? Like a fine violin?
I think so.
You think you are being played?
Oh, yeah.
He plays everyone, doesn't he?
But that doesn't matter.
I don't think so.
Playing the player a bit as well, though, I feel, because they're not unknowing. I mean, all the time they're making allusions in the article to, like when Armstrong suggests some things to improve modern cycling, they don't genuinely think he's a saviour of modern cycling. They know how ridiculous the whole scenario is, just being there and some of the things he's saying.
Mm.
So it's a bit of that.
Does Lance matter in cycling now and in the future?
Yes. Firstly, because you've got to learn from Lance. Learn the lessons of... Because I've just been writing something about this for the website, and it's not so much about Lance as a whole kind of culture. And at a certain time, there's going to be another champion who possibly gets caught, and then people are going to ask, what are we doing to stop this? What's changed since the Lance revelations? And what good is going to come from exposing Lance? So I think he still matters.
I'm less inclined to think he does matter. What I do think to a large degree is how he has become, you know, the whipping boy for everything that's wrong in cycling and is expunged from the Tour de France records while nobody else is, which just seems to me quite ridiculous. So does he matter in the modern day cycling in the great scheme of things? No, probably not. But does he matter historically? Then yes,
he matters because he was a champion.
Yeah, same as the rest of them.
Yeah. So you would see it being a bit ridiculous that he's expunged from the history books and
totally.
The rest aren't. And yeah. you'd go along with his accusation of hypocrisy.
Yeah, I do totally. I seem to remember a podcast a while back, and you were talking to Guy, and Guy said, "Look, this I've got a sort of." You know, a view on Lance that isn't very popular is that Lance actually made cycling hugely popular and we've got a lot to thank him for. I think the rest of us sort of sat there, we're kind of going, ooh, you know, but, well, you know, isn't he right?
And so Ruler has been among those and the leading media organisations, I suppose, to promote and celebrate Marco Pantani. And in the piece, Lance says, you know, what's going on there? You know, how come it's the great Marco Pantani and I'm the number one pantomime villain? We've got all the Ruler mugs over there with all the different riders on them done by Richard Mitchelson. Will there be a Lance mug?
That's a good question. Actually, I just saw Richard Mitchelson's mug, his face, I should say, at the door waving through. I'm not sure that's a route he'd prefer to go down, but... this is something that comes up every so often. It is, people will say, so they've gone after him. Why haven't they gone after such and such, you know, this other rider? Well, because that guy treated us well. You know, that guy sort of just kept his counsel and didn't actually make us feel Didn't make any enemies.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, I think. You know, and that's why. That's why Lance has got hammered, because he did make a lot of enemies.
But that suggests that our process for making moral judgments about people is not about whether they cheat at their sport; it's about whether they treat other people badly. Which is, I don't know. It doesn't feel satisfactory.
Cycling is a professional sport. As long as it remains a professional sport, there will be cheating, same as any other professional sport. I mean, it's as simple as that. So,
any profession, yeah. I'll go as far as saying, not just sport, there's, you know, banking, journalism, whatever. People will try to find a shortcut. They'll plagiarise, for example, in journalism where they can, occasionally, if they want to. But going back to Pantani and the hypocrisy, it's a lot of it is the projection of personality when they're riding, either by the rider or by the media. And Pantani, just taking that example, he was seen as childlike and endearing, a hero. And Armstrong didn't have any of those qualities. He was abhorrent. He was a bully. And that's where a lot of the problem lies. It's a simple thing of how a fan sees that champion.
So when people talk about new generations in cycling, we should just put that to one side as a kind of wishful thinking. I mean, it's really fascinating, isn't it, to see TJ Van Garderen training with Lance Armstrong. I mean, is that not going to create a few ripples when those pictures come out into the internet?
Well, that was quite amazing for us. And I think we didn't know that, did we?
We didn't know they were doing that until the photos came
out. I think there's a slightly different take on it in the States. I don't think the States... The Americans seem to be as horrified by the whole scenario as we are.
But a new generation... doesn't mean a kind of new start. I think you can't draw a line in the sand. What we're looking at is a culture of doping and pro cycling since the start, pretty much, with strychnine and all that. I know what they were on, so you just have to hope it'll improve slowly. That's a realistic way of looking at it, I think.
And so one of the ideas that Lance Armstrong has in the end of of this piece, which is just the first part of a two-part, second part will be in issue 52, is that the sport is in a terrible state in terms of the way it's organised, the way the revenue is shared between the organisers, the teams and the riders. And he recommends something which is actually quite a lot like what Jonathan Vaughters is recommending, is that there's more of a revenue share from TV revenue with the teams. But Lance is also arguing that the riders should have more of a personal stake in the business somehow, principally, I guess, in the form of a riders' union that they have to pay a subscription to. And he thought that if they have a stake in future sponsorship income, they will realise that things that are likely to tarnish the reputation of the sport and put off sponsors. So, for instance, look at Germany, the biggest market potentially for cycling on TV in Europe, you know, completely ditched professional road racing in the wake of the sort of doping revelations, I suppose, with the telecom T-Mobile teams. And they would go, well, look, we don't want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. Do you buy that? Do you think that kind of rider union and a riders having a stake in the TV money directly and a feeling that they have some equity in the system, do you think that's going to make the difference that Lance argues that it will, or is he just being over-optimistic?
It sounds like a hell of a big ask to me, but you know, it's all very well to sit there and spout these ideas when you're not actually involved in it and you're not going to say anything. I'd be more interested to sort of read what Vaughters had to say on the subject, because he's somebody that actually could have some sway in that. But you know, I mean, what Lance effectively says is, if I'm not mistaken in the piece, is like, we know the guys who are on it, basically.
Yes, that's so, what I thought. Yeah, that was interesting, wasn't it?
We know who's on it, so we can out them ourselves.
If it pays us more money to out people than to...
Yeah.
cover them up, yeah. then riders will do it, which I guess is, you know, it's the mercenary nature of being a professional road racer, is that if you can change the incentives in some way, that they can be incentivized. That's the only language that people understand, isn't it? It's money.
Yeah. And you look at the other end of the spectrum, is at the other end of the magazine, is Colin's story on the Yellow Fluo team. Is you've got a small Italian team, not a lot of money, always scrabbling around for sponsors, and they have three riders who test positive. And that puts the jobs of 50 other people maybe in jeopardy, what those three guys have done. And that's you kind of got to wonder how they feel about that.
Assuming that they were just freelancing on the EPO, they weren't. It wasn't part of a team program.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
No, no.
I think Colin really comes to a conclusion on that. I mean, he does seem to. He does seem to like the team owner, or at least the sporting director.
Yeah.
And trusts them and thinks that they are freelancing. But that, you know, that does tend to be the line that comes out, doesn't it? With Astana, oh well, God, they've just been off, gone off and been naughty. We told them not to, says Alexander Vinokourov.
Well, it was ever thus, yeah, I guess. So, I don't know, you have to draw your own conclusions,
yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah. Right, let's move on. Let's move on to a climb in the Alps, a climb that's very celebrated in cycling history. Andy, this is your piece, illustrated with some fantastic black and white photographs. Tell us a bit about the climb of the Col d'Izoard.
Yeah, okay. It's been in the Tour de France since 1922, I think. It's a Horcatory climb from both sides. The famous side of the climb is the south side from Giestra to the top. I think it's about 14 kilometres at 8%, and it's brutal. It really is tough. The funny thing with the Izoard is that it has never hosted a summit finish, and it probably never will. I think mainly for space reasons. It's just a medium-sized car park and a sweet vendor at the top. There's no place to fit the Tour Circus, which is a real shame because it is a very tough climb, and it is one of the most kind of arrestingly beautiful climbs in the Alps. I mean, I can only compare it, both the vista on the summit and the Castes to maybe the Galibier. You really feel like you're out of civilization. You feel a bit lonely if you want to go really deep. And actually, it's not mentioned in the piece, obviously, but I got vertigo for the first time on a goat track about 100 metres above the summit where Paolo was taking some of the photos that appear in the article. And I got a bit scared. I was kind of like, oh, I haven't eaten in about 7 hours. I'm getting tired. I don't want to put a foot wrong and fall off the mountain.
Yeah.
So it does funny things to men and cyclists in races.
And what are some of the great exploits that have taken place on its slopes?
Well, the Izoard was the big daddy of the Tour in the 50s and 60s. Really, it was Fausto Coppi and Gino Bartoli who raised the profile in 1949, I think it was, when Coppi and Bartoli went over top together. Bartoli implored Coppi to stay with him because it was his 35th birthday and let him win in Briançon, which is the traditional finish of the Izoard stage. And the next day, the Tour would be Coppi's. And so it was. And just constantly over the next 10 years, there were good battles. Luis Ombobe sealed his first Tour de France victory with a fine solo in the Alps and went alone over the Izoard. And he did it the next year too. And that's how it was built. As well as with the media, actually, like kind of with the imposing photos of the Casse Desert, I think people, fans in France, had never seen a place like this so imposing. And caricaturists like René Pelos, the famous Tour one, painting it as kind of a witch's hat. The famous Casse Desert, which is 2K from the top. So that's how the legend was really born.
So it sounds like the perfect mountain with a great history, wonderful scenery, amazing hairpins, as you'll see in the pictures. But it's falling out of favour.
That's right. The Tour's only been there, I think, 5 times in the last 20 years. That's partly because of for natural reasons that the Tour is always looking for new places, for new summits. It's got Wanderlust and it wants to find the next Izoard, the next Alpe d'Huez, the iconic climb for the future. Partly it's politics. I think Briançon also hasn't hosted a stage finish as often as it used to, and that's a natural endpoint for the stage. And also, as I said, it's space. I mean, space and my generation's attention span, like, because I've mentioned in the piece about the most recent exploit, Andy Schleck's in 2011. But even when I came to remember it first off, I thought, ah, yes, Schleck on the Galibier. Well, no, he, like, the climb that launched that great solo was the Izzard, and he attacked in a really canny steep place, 6K from the top. So it was good to revisit that.
So does it tell us something about the way in which the course of the Tour de France is changing?
It's more the riders and the fact that perhaps in the last 50 years, the field, the quality pool has narrowed so much, and the tactics and gains are so minute that they are waiting later and later to make that final move.
Cyclocross and Lars van der Haar, he does sound like a throwback. I mean, I love the way you describe the way he attacks these races from the very beginning, which reminds me of the way Chris Boardman used to race road races.
Well, just, he wasn't happy being in a bunch.
No, just go off the front. Yeah. Catch me if you can. Oh, it's great that people are doing that.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, in cyclocross is a slightly different kettle of fish in so much as there's no huge advantage in being in a bunch, but there still is. You know,
if you mentioned that the bunch reels them in, which suggests to me that there's sort of advantage.
There's never a bunch, basically. Once the first lap's over and everyone's settled down, you'll have little groups. Mm. But if you're in a group of five or six guys, you're in a better situation than being out on your own.
Why is that?
And you just
aren't you more likely to get caught up in a crash or something like that?
You are, but they really very rarely crash. I guess there is a certain amount of drafting going on. There's no two ways about it. You know, they're not hanging about when they're on the tarmac, and when it's dry, they are shifting, and you're going to be better off sitting on somebody's wheel than out on your own. You know, I kind of sort of say in the piece that Lars just blats out and turns the whole thing upside down and doesn't care what goes on behind him. And he doesn't always do that, if I'm brutally honest about it. But when he does it, the guys behind just can't seem to cope with it. It's just like, well, who's going to chase him? No, you chase him. You know, and sometimes it's just bye-bye Lars. They never see him again.
I mean, it's an interesting thing about cyclocross for a sport that does seem to have so many potential random variables with all the mud, with all the obstacles. You know, you'd think chance could play a large role, but it's the same people.
Yeah.
Same small group of riders who do well every time almost in the big races, isn't it? Why is that?
Because they are supremely skilled. And that's... That, as much as anything, is what I love about it, is just watching their skills, and everything they do is just honed to perfection. You see van der Haar dismounting, getting up some steps, remounting, and it's just one swift, beautiful, smooth action. And you try doing that at home, and it's actually really not easy, and not in the least bit comfortable. There's a little bit where I got Simon Burney to talk about Lars in there, and he says, well, you see someone like Sven Nys, and he can win over 20 races in one season, which, if you think about it, is quite incredible, because he doesn't make those mistakes that other people do. He kind of makes his own luck, because, you know, everything is absolutely spot on. Although, interestingly, I kind of said to Simon that seemed to have seen Sven drop his chain more than anybody else in the last couple of seasons, but that's because the camera's always on him. It's not to say that other people aren't dropping their chains as well. It's because Sven's right at the head of the race, and if he isn't at the head of the race, then the camera's going to be back looking for him to ask why he's not. Yeah. But you've got somebody who's actually capable of challenging him. Of course, Stibar can as well, but he doesn't always ride cross these days.
That does seem to be a problem for the sport, in the sense that people graduate to road racing full time.
Well, it is to an extent, in so much as you've got two, you know, fairly recent world champions, Stibar and Lars Boom, who have chosen to go to road careers, probably because it pays better. I'm not totally sure about that, but I imagine that's the case. Which is a shame, but thankfully Lars said he hates it, so he'll be staying with us on the dark side.
So it's a great shame that we don't have Robert Miller here with us. I think he was unavailable for the podcast, but he did write a column in which he describes his own experience, his own one and only experience in a cyclocross race, and makes the case for why he didn't like it. But I also think he makes the case for why it's a ridiculous sport. He basically says that, why don't you just have mountain bike racing? Because it's just, that's a lot better.
Yeah, well...
How do you evaluate the two? Side by side. Mountain bike racing...
If you're talking about cross-country mountain bike racing, to my mind, is nowhere near as exciting. Because it's much longer.
Well, the courses are...
Yeah, I mean, not only to ride, but to spectate. They disappear off into the woods for ages. They're not going particularly far. When they're grinding up little climbs on their granny rings, it's not great TV. Cyclocross is fast. It's furious. There's always something going on, you know.
But it does look to me as though they are riding the wrong type of bicycle for those conditions. That's my instinct.
What would you put them on?
Well, some sort of mountain bike, and maybe make the obstacles even more exciting and exaggerated, and you know, I'd like to see them have some more air. I mean, that I did pick that picture where Lars is getting a bit of air, but I'd like to see a lot of air, a lot more air.
Right. Yeah. You'd like to take it back to the 1950s when you were allowed to go through streams, and you know, they used to put you know, the hurdles that you get in steeplechase.
Yeah.
Yeah. They used to put those in. So it's things you'd basically have to crawl.
Because it does
over.
Seem as though the courses have been tamed for a bike that is not appropriate for essentially cross country pursuit, which seems to be a whole nest of compromises.
The courses have been tamed in order to make the racing faster and more exciting, and it's now reached a. I mean, when I say tamed, if you tried riding around a course like Koppenberg, for example, which is absolutely extraordinary. The descent is just, it's so steep. That's when you appreciate the skills that these guys and girls have got, you know, that they can get down that and stay upright. Because it's nuts, the idea of going down a bicycle on that. And so there's a whole variety of courses. That is another great thing about it. There are some courses that are a bit dull and a bit flat, whatever, so it's a really fast race. But there are some that are absolutely nuts.
Mm.
You know, Coxside, obviously, in the sand dunes is another famous one.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of others. The one, the World Cup in Valkenburg that they do, that was a really tasty course.
Ian, I remember you telling me this on the bike show. You think that it's a really good sport to start as a competitive cyclist if you've not done any competitive cycling, cyclocross is a good place to start. What, rehearse those arguments again.
Because it will teach you bike skills that you will never get just by riding a bike on a road. It will give you confidence on your bike. For kids, it's the best, absolutely best. So they can spend, you know, 3 or 4 years smashing around in the mud and acquiring those skills before they even go out on the road. So that's a good plus point from a parent's point of view. So in a road race, for example, if you're not fit, how long are you going to last in a bunch? And basically, you've never ridden a bunch. You're not quite up to it. You've been out riding on your own. You think, yeah, okay, I'm up to it. I've registered this average speed on my computer. Therefore, I can... You get in a bunch situation. You're out at the back after half a lap. Race over. Yeah, where are you going to go from there? Once you're dropped, you're out of it. In a cross race, don't matter how good you are, how bad you are, there's a race going on every single position. Even if it's for last place, you're going to be racing, and that's the beauty of it. You know, and you'll come across the line at the end, and everybody's standing there talking about what went on in the race with a big grin on their face. They're not skulking off to the dressing room, looking miserable. I'm not saying road races are all like that, but you know what I'm saying. The only downside is to wash the bikes afterwards. Frankly, what's your problem?
There's a great feature in the magazine about Condor Cycles, which is a famous London bike shop and mark of bikes. And it's a matter of some regret that I've spent how many years? 33 years as a London cyclist and never owned a Condor. And now I'm not a London cyclist, so that time is gone and I didn't do it. So that's some sadness for me there with Condor. But yeah, Condor, a well-known landmark in the world of cycling in London and in Britain at large. And instead of us talking about the memorabilia, I went over to talk with Grant Young, who's the son of Monty Young, who started And I asked him to tell us a little bit more about the history of the shop.
My father, Monty, started this very small business in Gray's Inn Road at number 90 in 1948. It seemed like a huge shop, but it was a tiny shop. But it was amazing what work went out of there and in this almost like a dungeon underneath where every wheel and every bike was built and lifted up the stairs by hand and out the front door. He loved cycling. It was his hobby. It was his sport. And it was just something he wanted to go into. I mean, it was a tiny, tiny little industry then. But he wanted to produce the best he possibly could in handmade bicycles, frames, wheels and everything about it. So he opened in Gray's Inn Road at number 90 in 1948.
Because there was quite a boom, wasn't there, in the post-war era? There were, because people had a bit more leisure time, a bit of money, and there were a lot of frame builders who come back from the war and suddenly had access to materials to build frames with.
Well, England had hundreds and hundreds on every street there was a frame builder. So there was, from south to north, there was great frame builders. Lots of just one man bands. There was nothing huge going on, but in every region people identified themselves. If it was up in the Midlands or if it was northeast, or there was always a frame builder. And most of the surrounding areas, club people used to use that particular frame builder.
And so, what was Condor known for? What would people think about? What were the values that people associated with Condor with in those days?
I think in the early days there was probably what made Condor famous was the hand cut lug frames. Though there were other frame builders that had their own designs, Condor's lug designs were unique to them. And I can remember, and still people say, that they used to look in the shop window and just draw over the colours, the flamboyancy, the modern looks of it, even the likes of Lord Alan Sugar. Yeah, at the time when he couldn't even afford a Condor, always wanted one.
So it was always something a bit special.
Yeah, always very, very high-end, high quality.
And so you, what are your earliest memories of, did you grow up sort of in the bike shop half the time?
Ever since I can remember, from a kid, after school every day, every Saturday, I just loved being there. And I left school at a really young age and went into the business, which was a tough business. And, my mother really didn't want me to go into it because it wasn't a business that you would go in to make money, let's say. You went into it because you loved it. It was a passion. It was a sport. It was a hobby. And I think that's really what I went into it for as well.
Well, we get a bit of a flavour of those days in the pictures in the magazine. I'm going to start. The opening spread is a Condor jersey. It looks like a training jersey. That purple, that is a colour that I associate with Condor. Was that a team colour? That purple. Why does that look right to me?
Yeah. Well, purple or mauve, whatever it was called, was the original. Was always the original colours of Condor, from the early Condor Mackeson, which was Whitbread Breweries when they sponsored the pro team. Mauve and white, or purple and white, became synonymous to Condor, and it was used throughout the years. It's come in and out of fashion. We've used it. We brought it back to life, and so on. And we still try and use it in some way.
Is there any particular reason why mauve was chosen? Sorry for calling it purple, by the way.
No, it's fine. I can't actually remember why. I just think it was quite a modern, vibrant colour in its early days.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, and elsewhere, I mean, there's fantastic shots of your dad here in his bodybuilding days. That was a sort of fitness thing, wasn't it, in those days, sort of the Charles Atlas?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And he loved, apart from cycling, he loved weightlifting, and had, he was very, very good at what he did, and you know, selected for to go to various things, and took it quite seriously, and I think, you know, was a champion in his day.
And he was particularly known for the wheels that he built, right?
Yeah, I think out of everything that he was known all over the world, and to this day, I still get people, if we're at a show, I still get people coming up to me, your dad made me some wheels 40 years ago, 50 years ago, they're still running true, they're still running straight. And he was a master craftsman at wheel building.
And so I'm looking through some of the pictures here. I mean, we've got his wheel building book, him at the truing stand, and then the Rolling Stones connection. How did that happen?
The Rolling Stones road manager is Alan Dunn, who's been a lifelong friend of my father and the family. Really keen cyclist and still is, and he got Mick Jagger and a few of the others involved in cycling, who they really, really enjoyed it. And, you know, there was a Condor bike made for Mick Jagger many, many years ago, which I believe he's still got and he won't part with. They were invited to various events and to the six-day races at Wembley when they were there, and they just enjoyed being part of it.
And so, moving forward to today, what does Condor stand for today? Is it the same thing that it stood for back in the 1940s and 50s? Or how has the business evolved in terms of, obviously, it's much bigger. You occupy a number of shops now on the Gray's Inn Road, and it's much more spacious. It doesn't look like that kind of classic Aladdin's cave of the classic bike shop. It's much, you know, it's a 21st century, you know, boutique, if you like. But how do you make that bridge between all the stuff that we can see in the magazine from the past and what there is now?
Well, I mean, it's lovely to have this 65, 66-year-old history that we've got. But our beliefs and the way we are and the way we treat people is exactly the same. However big we are, it will stay that way. Yes, we have grown the brand. The brand now has grown hugely. I mean, we have stockists all over the world selling Condor, you know, and lots of people say to us, well, why haven't you opened other shops and why haven't you expanded? Well, we've expanded in the sense of the Condor brand has expanded a lot, but for us to try and replicate what we've got here, the quality of what we've got here and the service we offer and, you know, the years of experience, you couldn't do it in a second or third or fourth shop, and it's not for us.
And what do you see the big challenges of bicycle retailing going forward? I mean, clearly there's a challenge from online, globalization challenge. What's sort of on the horizon, and what are you going to be doing here to meet those challenges?
There are challenges that we're faced with, and yes, online is one of them, and it's very tough for independent companies. I think you've got to be a certain size to keep in the business now, definitely. But our old ethics are still there, that we offer this fabulous service. People keep coming back. Every customer that goes out of here recommends someone else to come back. And as long as we keep doing what we do and not necessarily try to compete with, you know, the bigger mass producers, but to do what we do as a handmade product, I think our future is safe.
I was talking with Grant Young of Condor Cycles, and that brings us kind of to the end of the podcast, doesn't it? But for a competition.
Yes, indeed, Jack. Do you want me to ask the question for the competition?
Yeah, what is the prize? Let's get everyone's attention.
The prize is one of those nice sort of woolly winter hats, proper old school hats from Condor, and a couple of pairs of winter socks as well.
This is provided by Condor.
Provided by Condor.
Very nice of them.
Thank you very much, Condor. And the question is, Monty is a member of the Pickwick Bicycle Club.
Yes.
Every member of the Pickwick Bicycle Club has, not a nickname, sobriquet, is that the correct word? I don't hear pronounce that word.
Yeah.
Anyway, they do. They are allotted a character from
From Dickens.
From Dickens. What is Monty Young's Dickens character? Now, you might have to do a little bit of searching on a Google engine for this. Don't, whatever you do, put in Pickwick Club like I did earlier, because that ends you up on a naturist site, and it's not pretty, I can assure you. Pickwick Bicycle Club.
Or you could just flick through the issue, because I think the answer is somewhere in there.
Is it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
What do you do here? You're the editor, are you?
No idea.
Of course, editors don't read their own magazines, do they?
Better things to do. And the email address to send your entries to is competitions@ruler.cc.
competitions@ruler.cc. And we do have a winner for the previous issue 50, Paul Smith print, but we can't tell you who it is because Sam is not around.
Yeah, Sam very, very carelessly went on holiday. So, anyway, we'll have it soon.
We'll fill you in with that information and the answer in the next podcast, which will be the podcast for issue 52 next year, 2015. Yeah. Ian, Andy, thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure, as always.
Cheers, Jack.
Happy Christmas. Thanks for downloading this edition of the Ruler podcast. You can read Ruler magazine, which comes out 8 times a year, by taking out a subscription. Go to www.ruler.cc. Or you can pick up the latest edition at a growing number of bookshops and bike shops. If you've got an iPad, you can read the magazine on the iPad. Not only the current issue, but a handful of back issues as well. You'll find it in the Apple Bookstore.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.